This is an ASF Audits podcast.
Welcome to the SMSF Experts podcast, where we break down complex SMSF issues and legislation into simple terms. I'm Shelley Banton, Head of Technical at ASF Audits. And today, you had better strap yourselves in because we are tackling one of the most controversial assets that have ever hit SMSFs. Yes, we're discussing cryptocurrency. Love it or hate it, crypto has been around for over 15 years and is now being considered as a mainstream investment in SMSFs. So while we're going to be cutting to the chase today and discussing the big issues surrounding crypto, one of the main questions we're answering will be, is crypto a complying SMSF asset? And to help me, I'm pleased to welcome none other than Carolyn Bowler, CEO of BTC Markets. She has been involved with the blockchain and digital assets sector since 2015 and is considered one of Australia's foremost experts on crypto and regulatory framework, which makes her the perfect guest for today's pod. Welcome to the SMSF Experts, Caroline, and I'm so excited to be here talking to you today, discussing everything crypto. Let's get started. You've always been in the financial services industry, and before joining BTC Markets, you had previous roles with Blockchain APAC and Tagram, and they provided you with really, I guess, what is a deeper understanding of fintech and blockchain technologies with the industry that you're now in. And even though crypto's underpinned by blockchain, what was the catalyst, I guess, that got you to move across that divide and into that crypto space? Because that's a totally different area.
So, first of all, thanks so much for having me. And I can talk on this subject at speed, so do stop me. It's the Irish accent, I can't help it. I actually predated my time in Australia. I was in Singapore for 10 years, and it was when I was in Singapore that I first came into the world of fintech and later blockchain and crypto. And prior to that was an extensive background in financial services. So where the light bulb moment for me came with blockchain was understanding how we can verify transactions from anywhere in the world without needing to rely on one central point to do so. Now, as people who've worked in traditional finance and traditional systems will know, A, they're old. They're run on some Excel spreadsheet in an office somewhere. No one dare unplug that laptop because they don't know what's on that thing holding up the whole world's financial services system. And the problems that you have around reconciliation and if things fall over and so on. What I liked about initially Bitcoin and then Ethereum was how all of those transactions were all being simultaneously processed and verified. Okay, the Bitcoin blockchain takes maybe 10 minutes to verify. But once it's done, it's done. There's no going back. That transaction is done. And to me, that made so much immediate sense just about how applicable it was to the clunkiness of the existing financial services system. And that wasn't to say, that's not to slag off what we have already. What we have already has served a really great purpose. But to not want to iterate, change, and improve on that would be a form of madness. And money, which is value, has reimagined itself over history successively for millennia. This idea that it's always reliant on an IOU from a central bank is a fairly recent one. And quite frankly, if you ask somebody, well, what's backing the US dollar? Everyone goes, oh, gold. It hasn't had the gold in decades.
It hasn't been verified yet. Trump's going in to verify it, apparently.
Well, exactly. Well, we won't comment on that for fear of the comments. But it's more that that's a promise. That's literally a promissory note that is identifiable form. It's just a piece of paper, and the American government says that we'll stand over it. Absolutely open to inflation, open to, you know, the winds as they blow, the economic winds as they blow. And Bitcoin, I think, was fascinating to me because it was different to that. Do I think it's perfect? Not necessarily. Do I think we need to get rid of fiat or other forms of value? Also, no. And I don't agree with the premise that it needs to be binary, one or other. I don't think that works for everybody around the world. And this is an argument that we come up against quite a bit in a developed economy like Australia or Ireland, where I'm from, or say, you know, other countries where they've got a developed payment system, where it's like, oh, we don't need it because we have, you know, MPS or we have whatever kind of immediate payments that they have. Valid. But that's not the case for everywhere in the world. And if you look into countries that have been either their currency is unreliable, their central bank is unreliable, or they've been attacked by inflation, that it's gobbled up all the value of their savings, etc. Something like Bitcoin that holds its value over the long period, and if anything has been accretive, it's increased in value over the period, that suddenly makes a lot more sense for somebody. So to say to people, no, it's fiat or, you know, fiat or bust, is a very close-minded point of view on what has always been a very variable point around value all the way through human history. For goodness sakes, it was once piles of salt.
Tulips.
Tulips, even in the more recent time, that was tulips. I mean, we have to be more responsive to the world and the society that we're living in. And it is a digital era. We're increasingly moving into this digital era, and things like Bitcoin and other digital assets make sense in that world.
So it's interesting that you talk about a medium exchange, because the ATO has obviously, as we know, come out and said that it's not Bitcoin, in particular, and cryptocurrency is not cash or money. It's a CGT asset. So how does it represent then a medium of exchange, and what are people actually using it for besides just hodling?
The ruling on whether or not it's a cash asset is entirely within the frame of reference of that organization. That
Correct.
Doesn't necessarily yeah. reflect how people are using it right now, or how they're going to use it in the future. So, you know, I can understand why they have their point of view, and under the limitations and what it is that they're working under, not necessarily effective. And we get this question asked a lot. Mm. Oh, but nobody uses it. And you're going, no, hang on. Nobody in your world here in Australia that you're aware of is using it. That's not to say that nobody in the world is using it, because we've got blockchains that are running that show endless amounts of transactions. People are using it. It's just not necessarily in your immediate frame of reference. And that's possibly where the myopia is coming from, that people don't get it. And I don't also necessarily think that, you know, it's Bitcoin or bust. There are plenty of reasons why it potentially could be. It doesn't necessarily mean that, because you're a fool if you don't look at history and see that iteration that I spoke about and see how things evolve and change. Bitcoin could just be the first out the gate. There could be others to come after it. And certainly when you look at how things have changed, if you talk about stable coins in particular, which I'm happy to talk about, or central bank digital currencies, which is a bit of a controversial topic, also happy to talk about those. All of them ultimately are just a reimagination of how we send value and the format with which we send value. I have this great story, and this will probably illustrate it better, for something that's not considered like a cash. There's a person in my world whose adult son was in the United States for college, and it's Friday evening in the US, and he suddenly needs money, a few hundred dollars, but he's absolutely smashed out broke and needs money for an emergency situation. And he contacts his parents here in Australia. Can you help me? Now, anyone who's worked in traditional finance will tell you, after a cutoff time, particularly on a Friday, over a weekend, forget about it.
Yep.
You're not getting anything.
Till Tuesday.
Exactly, right? Because of the T++ on the settlement.
Mm-hmm.
That's getting quite nerdy, but yes. And instead, the dad had an inspired moment, set up an account on BTC Markets. The son in the United States set up an account with an American equivalent. And the dad sent the kid money using cryptocurrency. So this exchange of value happened from Australia to the United States, cross-border payment, and using Bitcoin, it would have happened in 10 minutes. Using other currencies as a form of value would have happened in seconds. And on the other side of that, he can either use the Bitcoin itself to pay for whatever it is he wanted, or he cashed it out into US dollar, which I think is what the kid did. And suddenly this kid had gone from stony broke and not being able to see any money for days to being looked after by his parents. So the exchange of value that happens so fast, so reliably, because it's all decentralized around the world, the computers that are running the blockchain all over the world, and so inexpensively, that all of a sudden this stuff makes sense. And as somebody who's worked in traditional finance, you and I both know the challenges there are around cross-border payments. And don't forget, like, to open these accounts, you're fully AML KYC'd on either end, right? You're already doing your CTF transaction. You're already looking at that to make sure from a compliance point of view that you're covered, you know, where the account gets opened and the purpose of it. But isn't that a game changer? Why wouldn't we want more of that? That gets me.
Yeah, it is a game changer, and it's sort of the disruptive technology that we would be looking at in terms of what can the blockchain do. And we don't see any of that in SMSF world because it is just being taken on board to just sit there, and hopefully it'll still have a value at the time of retirement when somebody's looking to cash it out and take it as a lump sum, because as we know, you can't take it as a pension payment. So there's a whole lot of rules and regulations around that. So from what you're saying, outside of what our small SMSF world is, it's still disrupting, the technology is still disrupting and having continual impact and influence throughout the world.
It has only started. We're not even at the beginning of the end. We've just started on what this is going to be. And the technology behind it, the way of thinking behind it, when it spreads out into digital assets, it won't just be that you've got cryptocurrency that's in digital format and your SMSF. You're going to have your BHP shares are going to be tokenized. You're going to find your money market fund is also, you know, on chain. You're going to have a variety of different assets, as well as, you know, your usual, you know, shares that are held in registry and so forth. But the interesting bit is when you bring in that tokenization, which happens on blockchains like Ethereum in particular. I mentioned Ethereum.
Yes.
Bitcoin's number one. Ethereum is number two in terms of market cap. So probably is the best bet to discuss those. And Ethereum is probably the most widest used at this stage. And so when you start tokenizing assets and tokenizing money market funds in particular, they've been notably successful. The velocity of use around these funds, the ability to switch in and out, the ability to use them as collateral, also the functionality of them, it's a game changer for how we're going to think about financial services. We're not there yet, and we've got lots of steps to get to before at that point where this is a norm. But when we think about where we are in digital assets, that's what I'm saying, we're barely at the start. We're barely beginning. We're barely even thinking about it. The infrastructure has been thought through. There are products that are live in financial services. I know for a fact I was talking about with, there was a money market fund in Hong Kong that went live with Standard Chartered, I think in December of last year. It's starting to come through in tokenized form. I mean, so it's starting to come through. But there's still a distance to go. And certainly here in Australia, we are so far behind the curve. It's not even true, but it's happening elsewhere. And the point being that, like, if it's happening on Wall Street, it's going to be happening on Main Street here in Australia soon enough.
Yeah, well, we've probably got to get the NPP up and running first, Caroline. So we'll take a ticket maybe. But anyway, let's get into the crypto discussion. Actually, no, what I did want to do is I wanted to ask you a question about Bitcoin in particular, I guess, and the blockchain. Who is Satoshi Nakamoto?
So nobody knows.
Nobody knows. Certainly not an Australian. We've had that debunked.
You're not that person.
Yeah.
And that's a court case to prove that.
Yes.
Part of the mystique is the fact we don't know who they, him, she, or they are. No one knows, because it could be a collective of people. And certainly back in the early days, there was talk that it was a small collective of people. And there's all kinds of questions about which organization they may potentially have been working for when they devised it, and lots of speculation. It's really irrelevant. And if anything, they did a solid by not coming forward as a human or humans, because then you can project all kinds of qualities onto the project that just frankly don't exist. There's a lot to be said for just being like the anonymous heck behind the
donor.
Whole thing. Yeah, exactly. And we don't need to know. And they were so smart in what they chose to do, whether they, as I say, whoever the individual is or individuals are, they've done us a solid by not stepping into the spotlight.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. So everybody can just think whatever they like, and it can be as romantic and as sexy and as, you know, cutting edge as you want. But, you know, really it's a pack of nerds in a database, in a warehouse somewhere. So anyway, okay, what drives the price of crypto, and really what's the volatility, especially when, you know, there's always those, it has no tangible asset backing, and, you know, how does that work?
So if you look at Ethereum, say, for this example, and there are others as Solana, and there's others that are of that type, and what I would call utility tokens, utility platforms, and they're the blockchain economy is being built on platforms like Ethereum and Solana.
Yeah.
So in those ecosystems, the technology, the services that are being built on those, you have to pay for them using Ethereum. You have to pay for them using Solana.
Yeah.
So there is always a purpose to a use case for the Ethereum that you have. You may need to use it to access, as I say, a service or a product. So that's a very easy way to get your head around it. And it is technically the currency, if you like, of those particular chains. So that's one way of looking at it. And if you want to look at then, well, how would you derive a value from that? You would look at, well, how many people are building on those platforms? How many projects are on there? How many people are using those platforms? And you can kind of look at those. These are stats that are available online, and you can kind of see the growth or not on either of them. So that's for those particular ones. For Bitcoin itself, as I mentioned at the top, it was meant and intended to be a peer-to-peer currency. It was meant to be something that you and I use,
yeah,
that's outside the control of a government, outside the control of a central bank. And the determination of the value is matched. It's your traditional supply and demand. They've controlled the supply. They've said there's only ever going to be X number of Bitcoin in circulation. They've hard coded that. And every 4 years, the amount of Bitcoin that comes into the market decreases. So it's on a decreasing rate. So they control the supply. And on the demand side, rising inflation throughout the world is helping on the demand side because people are trying to find a way to hedge. As I say, maybe not necessarily in countries like Australia per se, but in other countries around the world, this is really, really valuable. And so that's where you would find it for Bitcoin. And again, you can kind of see the numbers of people who are, in that case, you're looking for the number of wallets that hold Bitcoin, and you can see the growth in the number of wallets, meaning the number of, well, as it says, wallets. And,
wallets.
And it's assumed then that the person and organization is on the other side of those wallets. And that's where you are with that. When you're looking at the likes of what they're called meme coins, which are the fun ones.
Yep.
So that can be a harder one to crack. Some of those meme coins are fun and are kind of representative of culture, the internet culture. And they're probably some of the bigger contribution or contributors to volatility in the market. And they're probably what are known as the, you know, the pump and dumps and some of the rug pulls. However, other people have made a ton of money trading those guys, and fair play to them. I'm all for people making money. I have no problem with that whatsoever. You go for it. But with the meme coins, it's much harder, in my view, to ascribe a specific value to them. And perhaps there are other people who are better positioned to do so. There's a demand for them. We personally don't, you know, list them on BTC markets, or we go down other pathways instead. But other really good exchanges here in Australia and overseas certainly do. And perhaps they would be in a better position to talk about how they put a valuation on those. And then you go into tokens like stable coins. So if you look at the best known one, which is USDC or Tether, those are both linked to the price of the US dollar. So it's incredibly handy if, for example, your company has an import-export relationship with the United States or with a country that takes US dollar as an underlying currency. And you've got a format of that that's now digitalized that you can send, and it's always linked and redeemable at par with a company that will accept US dollar. And again, it sends over in seconds. It's incredibly quick, but it's dollar backed. So its value is the dollar. And that's not intended to fluctuate too wildly away from that. Australia doesn't have a lot of those in use at the moment, despite the best efforts of AUD stablecoin issuers here in Australia, of which there are a few who are going through ASIC to try and get, I suppose, approval. I'm not sure what the word is for their AUD stablecoins. There's a couple of them in hopefully going to be able to go live soon, which will be really exciting.
That's really interesting. So when you're talking about, I guess, the most popular type of cryptocurrencies, as you said, Ethereum, Bitcoin, Solana. So if then you've got cryptos that are maybe outside, I don't know, the top 100, or are you looking at by per wallet? And the number of wallets, I'm not sure how you're necessarily measuring the popularity, but is it those coins that are sort of, you know, more down the list, does that make them more riskier if they don't have that sort of trading happening?
Everyone's portfolio is different, right? So I don't want to give anything that can be construed as financial advice, right? This is all very general.
Yeah, no, this is...
All very general. But what I would suggest, and what is a really good resource, is to go to the likes of CoinMarketCap.com. It's a website, and on it lists all the tokens that are available, or in the main, as far as I know, and it's running into the thousands, and you can go through. But I think what would probably be most helpful is if you look at the market cap breakdown. And when I talk about how Bitcoin and Ethereum are number one and two, invariably they make up anything between 60 to 7% of total market cap sits in two. So, you know, really, once you get outside the top 10 or top 20, you're looking at a much, 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 much smaller amount of market cap. And I think it's probably sensible to consider the advice that you would apply if you were looking at traditional markets and you're getting down into like the penny stocks and how you view those assets and how you want to invest in those. And I think that's probably a decent shorthand, like a mental shorthand of which to review it. Not financial advice, obviously, and different cases and so forth. But if you're looking at how am I constructing my, you know, foray into cryptocurrency, you know, that's probably a good place to start on CoinMarketCap and go in and have a, you know, dig around, get familiar with it. It's a really helpful resource, dare I say it, but it is a really helpful resource to get to know it. We've got similar content on our platform, you know, breakdown of the different coins and what they're all about, but we wouldn't have the comprehensive list because we don't list that many. We only list about 40 odd trading pairs on purpose, because for us, it makes no sense to me to list penny stocks.
Yeah. And you could even go in the graphs on CoinMarketCap. ECAP is amazing. So, yeah, a very good resource for those looking to dip their toe in, if you like. Now, before we get into, I guess, the compliance aspects of crypto, I'd just like to talk to you about the regulatory side of things, because this is an ongoing issue in digital assets. And in fact, there is very little regulation, as we know, and AUSTRAC has also identified that crypto's been exploited by criminals for money laundering, and as we know, lots of scams going on, especially in SMSF. And this undermines a lot of the good work that are being done by those in the industry, such as yourself, who are actively engaged in enhancing that digital asset regulation in Australia. And of course, when we've got the reputable exchanges such as BTC Markets, they're registered with AUSTRAC and also they meet the KYC AML regulations. But it's those non-compliant exchanges that are out there that are still operating illegally. They're of concern. And last year, AUSTRAC established an internal crypto task force to take action against those crypto ATM providers that don't comply and were obviously laundering money. So what is on the regulatory roadmap for us in Australia, and when can we get some traction?
Yeah, so I'm 5 years in this job asking the exact same question.
Oh, okay. Sorry.
So when you guys get the answer, you come and let me know. Now, we have, ASIC have put out a paper for submission that's just closed, and in it they've outlined kind of how they would like to progress with cryptocurrency. It's certainly been met with interest from the industry, because we have been clamoring for years for this. So, you know, that is a helpful step forward. It's also now against a backdrop of much deeper political engagement from both of the major parties. They are now very active on this topic, because I think they understand the majority, like the sheer number of Australians who are in crypto.
Yes.
And also the concerns being, and to your point, I think you were making there, so tell me if I'm wrong, but it's very hard for people outside the industry to know who the good actors and the bad actors are.
Correct.
No way to distinguish it at the moment. And that is a problem. There's a problem across the board. It's even a problem when you talk about with scams. And this is something that we talk and we dedicate a lot of time on this, a lot of education on this. But I was at a conference last week in Sydney, and I said this to the room of bankers, like the problem being, because the bank industry, for its own reasons, have decided to hold the whole industry at arm's length, it's created a sense of, A, that we're all the same, which we are absolutely not. But also then they have no way of knowing who's the good and the bad. Like there's no way of saying, well, particularly if you look talking from an AML KYC point of view, like you can tell, like you know who the good and the bad are because you can see all the data points coming through. And so that's a concern that there right now is no way. And we need the regulation to come in to help distinguish who are the good actors from the bad ones. What it also does, because as I say, cryptocurrency has been given this reputation, rightly or wrongly, that all of us are the same. When banks or others come out with those kind of statements, Australians who are in crypto, who have made money with crypto, who are having a good experience with the asset, are going, that doesn't ring true to me. I don't believe what you're saying to me. And if they get caught up in scams, as we have seen, their attitude is, you're just trying to stop me from making money off of an asset that you don't have any control over. And that's why you're telling me this. And even to ourselves, having similar experiences with people saying, no, my advisors told me you'd say this. But because of the amount of mistrust that this has created within Australia, the fact that we haven't got a license I can point to in the same way that the ASX or financial advisor or CBA or others and say, this piece of paper gives me the authority to tell you this is what's going on. So it creates just such a division in people's minds over what it is. Who do I believe? Do I believe this advisor that I've met off the internet, or do I believe this cryptocurrency exchange because this advisor is telling me, all kinds of stuff? So it is really problematic.
Do you think that the ASIC's licensing initiative and the Treasury's proposal paper goes far enough? Because I'm a little bit, you've got to start somewhere, but I just would have liked to see a little bit more meat in the sandwich.
One of the other issues with it, though, with the licensing regime, is that there isn't, in our view, enough staff in ASIC who understand the space. They've been on the learning curve, same with other regulatory bodies. They've been on the learning curve. And I don't doubt the commitment of the staff. And certainly the engagement we've had from the digital asset team in recent times has been phenomenal compared to where it was before. So I do think they're taking it seriously. And I don't think they're dismissive of it or anything at all like that. But there is a lack of people who understand our asset class sufficiently yet to actually properly come in and regulate us is my concern. So meat on the bones, I think one of the advantages to starting with, let's just get a baseline of behavior down would be a good place to start. Like the Ten Commandments of do not steal, do not rob from your clients, make sure you get cigarettes.
Yeah.
I mean, basics like that would be a good place to start.
Yeah.
And then build on from there. The thing last week in Sydney, and there was people there from the European Union who've been involved in setting up the EU's MiCA Act or MiCA, depending on how you want to pronounce it. And they said at the time that people talked about maybe bringing NFTs or other assets in decentralized finance into the law. And they pushed back on that because they said, we don't know enough yet. It's still too new. We don't know enough. Let's cut our teeth. Let's get the basics down and take it from there. And I think that's actually quite an astute approach to take, given there's so much we don't yet know about this class, asset class, and how much it's going to change. But things like, as I say, keep your grubby paws off of a client's assets is usually a pretty good, pretty strong opener. And certainly with the cryptocurrency business is, there's been some that have not heeded that. So we need that rule.
Do you think that, obviously Australia's regulation landscape isn't going to change anything worldwide, but do you think that when we get to a point of regulation, across the board, that potentially that's going to affect crypto prices, and we might see, and I'm not saying that's going to be good or bad in which way going up or down, but do you think that investors would maybe then look at reevaluating their portfolios, in terms of investing in crypto?
Yeah, I think there's probably a few different ways on that. I mean, certainly for investors looking at the likes of BlackRock coming in and creating products on Bitcoin and so forth, and the amount of ETFs that are available now are increasing.
That's crazy.
Right? So, I mean, there's vehicles to come into the space through using traditional wrappers. You don't necessarily have to go and hold your own wallet and so forth. So there's that. I do think that Australia getting a licensing regime of some kind will level us up to the rest of the world, because the rest of the world has gone ahead. And so we do need to level up, particularly considering how much of the country's gross domestic product is based out of financial services in Sydney. I mean, it's considerable. And obviously Melbourne for asset management. So, we need to be shipshape about this, because this is the future, and we need to get experience now amongst a broader swathe of the workforce before it becomes the standard or a standard. And the question mark about whether or not it will be the standard is gone, because financial services titans in the likes of JP Morgan, Morgan Stanley, Goldman Sachs, etc., have already decided that digital assets on chain are the future of financial services. They've moved from proof of concept into live product. They ain't following this stuff for fun. BlackRock don't launch a product because maybe it'll work. It's not an R&D thing for them. They see money and they're coming for it, and we will follow suit in due course. So it is an economic imperative for Australia that we get behind this and get it in place and support and encourage the amount of talent that's come out of Australia, particularly when we go overseas. Singapore and Dubai and various other locations over the United States. I've been all over the place in the recent 18 months. And the amount of Aussies is unreal who are in this space, who can't stay here because they can't find a framework to work under from a regulatory point of view. And so have shipped out and gone to Tokyo or gone to London or gone wherever, because there they can find something that works for them. So it'd be good to get some of that talent back.
Yeah, no, 100%, and get the Brains Trust back into Australia. Yes. That'd be great. All right, let's deep dive into crypto in SMSF. When we first saw trustees moving into crypto around about 2017, when we saw the price of Bitcoin start to rise. And as we've often said on this pod, SMSFs can invest in anything as long as it meets the sole purpose test, it's allowed by the trust deed and the investment strategy. And of course, crypto can meet all of those requirements without a problem. But given that, as we've said, the mindset's still out there that it is a little bit of a high risk investment because of that price volatility, et cetera, why then does it become an appropriate, I guess, investment for a fund which is holding the retirement savings of its members? So how does that connection work?
Okay, so I wouldn't want to assume any investment manager is going to be listening to me for advice on cryptocurrency.
No. This is compliance. So we're not licensed to give financial or legal advice yet. So,
But it goes back to, I mean, I remember from the banking days, like the advice that would be given to clients about alternative investment products would be anything between 5 to 15% of your portfolio, depending on how much you want to juice your returns, how much risk appetite you have, is worth looking at a variety of alternates. And I think that cryptocurrency falls into that bucket. That's how I would look at it. And I'm thinking they're probably primarily around the larger asset class, simply because if you want something that's going to be liquid and has a history of liquidity, and also has got a price history that you can look at, and you can understand a bit more like price discovery around it. And so something like a Bitcoin or Ethereum is quite an easy first foray in, because you can do all of those different pieces with it. And with Ethereum too, and with Bitcoin, as I mentioned, like there's a manner of putting a price on or understanding what could be behind some of the growth. So that's very helpful. What I also think is quite helpful, even for people who are going, oh, I just want to dip my toe in and not do too much because they don't want the risk, which is completely valid. The way it differs from buying a share, like if you want to invest in BHP, you've got to buy an entire BHP share at a minimum. Like you've got to buy, I don't know what BHP is trading at the moment, but you have to buy at least one whole BHP share to get exposure. You do not have to buy one whole Bitcoin to get exposure to Bitcoin. If you've got $10, you can just buy $10 worth of Bitcoin, and you do not have to justify the expense or the outlay to buy more than that. That to me flips this on the head. And I think it also equally, when you're doing tokenization, flips it on the head, because now I don't need to buy.
There's no minimum parcel.
And that is a game changer. Yeah. And I think that's where it's really helpful then, if you are looking at some kind of allocation and you're trying, as I say, you want to slightly juice your risk appetite a little bit, but don't want to get overexposed, you can come in at very small amounts and still see an uplift, potentially, you know, depending on the volatility and which way the direction's the market is going. You know, you can still see some of that uplift without feeling as though, oh my God, I've put the house on the price of a meme coin or something. So, you know, obviously, which would not be a good advice in my view. So I think that's one of the aspects that I find really helps people get comfortable with it. And obviously, like anybody, you know, it's the most sensible thing to do is to come in, open an account, which you can do all this online with all the exchanges. I can't just talk about ourselves, but you open an account, you put $10 in, and you put an order into the market and say, I want to buy $10. Bang, you now have exposure to cryptocurrency in the most easy and straightforward way. And then you can just check in. We've got mobile apps. You can look at mobile apps, ourselves and all the others. So it's very accessible trading. There's no middleman. There's no broker. And you're buying from other Aussies who hold the crypto. So you come onto our exchange for particular, and I want to buy 10 Bitcoin. I'm buying it off of you, Shelley.
Because I wish I had 10 Bitcoin, right? Caroline.
Me too. I wish I had the money to buy 10 Bitcoin. I sadly do not. But I think that's the point I want to make with this, that the additional layer of flexibility that you can get with cryptocurrency doesn't currently exist.
Oh, you can buy 1/15th of a Bitcoin. You don't have to buy a whole Bitcoin. You can literally buy 0.00007749 of a Bitcoin. Exactly. And I think that's the point that you're making. Yeah. One of the things that you touched on as well before was the wallets, which and also the accounts. Like, we used to see a lot of accounts being opened up because the exchanges weren't set up for SMSFs. Now, as you said, everybody is, which is fabulous. And obviously, we want to see all of those accounts in the held in the name of the trustee as trustee for the fund, so that there's compliance with Reg 409A. If there's not, well, you're going to get a slap on the wrist from your auditor, and potentially, depending on how much you've invested in, you're going to get an ACR lodged as well. But one of the things about the wallets is is obviously keeping that information, the private keys, safe and secure, because it's estimated that about 20% of all Bitcoin has been lost because people forget their private keys.
Gosh.
And they've just kissed their crypto goodbye. So do you have any tips, I guess, on how to keep a wallet safe and secure, and you know, what's the best practice there?
Tattoo your passwords on your eyeballs.
Just, good advice.
Not to be flippant about it. This is something, an area that I feel is absolutely ripe for somebody much smarter than me to come in with a solution who understands from the technology point of view, because it is really quite challenging, particularly given, you know, you hear conflicting advice of people saying, well, don't write it down anywhere. You've got to remember it. I'm sorry. I'm a perimenopausal woman. I can't remember yesterday. What, you remember my codes? Like, this is not going to happen.
So, and it's not a short code.
No, exactly. So that doesn't work for me. Mm. What we have found, actually, to be perfectly honest, the vast majority of clients that we've had, and we've been around for over 10 years, the vast majority of clients tend to leave cryptocurrency on the exchange.
Really?
That's actually what we find, more than withdrawals. Regular Aussies just chuck it on the platform and leave it there. So another reason when I talk about the need for regulation, I mean, they can, you know, the fact that if that's actually the behavior of Australians and they're leaving cryptocurrency on platforms all over the world, that needs to be regulated in some manner, because that's an asset with somebody else. Now, they're lucky with us because I'm so boring and legit, it's ridiculous, but I can only stand over my platform. I only know what we're doing.
Yeah. And look, and I guess the point you're making here, Caroline, is that I could open my own exchange tomorrow and I could go, hey, everybody, come in and invest in Shell Bank or Shell Exchange, whatever. And guess what? I'm also going to issue Shellcoin and have a little party with everybody, get the money in. And I have no accountability.
I am loving this business plan we're coming up with, Shelley. I am definitely all in on Shellcoin. Where are we doing this? This sounds genius.
Oh dear, if only. But no, it's not going to happen, I'm afraid. I'll just stay in my boring little pod seat and keep going. So yeah, look, I think that, and we try and obviously assist our clients in terms of saying, make sure that you've kept that information safe and secure, because typically it's one trustee who's, you know, the crypto guru if you've got the mum and dad super fund, and they're the ones that have got all the information. So if you're, you know, okay, if you're only slightly invested, and you potentially, and you know, the crypto trustee drops off the perch, well, then you're going to lose that crypto if you don't have that private key and all of the wallet details documented.
Lots of different ways and it's very individual, I think, to the person. Mm-hmm. And there's, like, depending on the amount of crypto you're looking after, you can look at, there are different security solutions on the market that involve multiple people to verify and tick boxes, and you can white label addresses that the currency gets sent to, so that it can only go to this particular wallet and it can't go anywhere else. You know, there are different steps that you can put in place on that. But that kind of goes up and up and up in sophistication, depending on the amount of money that you've got in there. And I think it probably is where your degree of comfort truly sits, and that tends to determine the security aspects that you take. I mean, lots of people would have their crypto wallets in their sock drawer and their passwords in their, you know, pants drawer. Like, it's not uncommon thing to do. And I think perhaps too, what we've often found too, is that people who bought a few years ago are suddenly going, oh, I don't know my passwords anymore. I don't know where they are. Or they'll ping us and say, how can I get my cryptocurrency back? You know, you took it off our platform. So we don't know where it is. We have no way of knowing. And that's on you to caveat emptor in that sense, if you take it off. Say there are some people who naturally then would just prefer to leave it with us. And then the you have the counterparty risk of us, I suppose, on the other side of that. But I mean, that's a bet that people make. So,
well, that's it. I guess one of the problems which concerns me is that trustees may not necessarily understand the product that they're investing in. Mm. So, you know, they can, without almost even knowing, sign up for crypto derivatives, and futures and options and portfolio hedging and CFDs and structured products and decentralized. The list just goes on. And all of these products come with a significant risk. And, you know, one of the things we hate as auditors is people losing money out of their super, of course. And the other side of it, it's also virtually impossible to audit these types of assets. So, you know, from a compliance standpoint, a trustee can't give a charge over assets and derivatives unless it's through an approved exchange listed on in SIS into Schedule 4. But of course, none of these crypto exchanges that are offering these types of products are approved, let alone on ASIC's radar. So from a risk and compliance perspective, how can trustees protect themselves and understand what they're investing in, especially when the platform can camouflage what the product is and they have no real knowing of what the risks are? And as we've said before, they may not even have an AFSL license, and it just extrapolates it significantly.
100% agree that this kind of scenario just fills me with absolute horror.
Yes.
If you find that, you know yourself best as a trustee, you know where the outer boundaries of your knowledge sits. And if you're finding yourself being pressured from any angle to do more in crypto than you're comfortable doing, that should send off every alarm bell going in your head. Crypto itself isn't specifically complicated. It really isn't. And as we were saying previously, these products themselves aren't specifically complicated. Complexity also for an SMSF, given the timeframes you're dealing with, quite why you'd want to go into a crypto derivative or a crypto future, given the timeframe of what you're dealing with, doesn't really make, to me anyway, doesn't make a lot of sense for a crypto portfolio, given the relative youth of derivatives within crypto, given how you're likely going overseas to buy a derivative product in crypto because there's not many that can issue them here in Australia, which brings a whole other risk profile around what it is that you're doing and where your assets are going, et cetera, et cetera. And it just would create to me there does seem to be in a section of the industry almost a perception of you have to be in everything and doing everything to get the results.
FOMO.
Is rubbish. Mm. Rubbish. And I would kind of hope that if you're a trustee of an SMSF, you've got a bit, as we say at home, a bit of cop on to realize that you don't need to be juicing your returns, as I say, to that extent. This is still a really young, partially regulated industry. And I say that as somebody who's a CEO of an exchange, but it's a partially regulated industry. You're already, moving into something that is really cutting edge when it comes to the tech behind it and the use cases. And as I said to you, it's still very much at the start of it. We still don't know where we're going with this. It's the beginning of the beginning. So chill. You're grand. Don't need to be going in and buying all these, not for an SMSF.
Yeah.
Like your time frame on that is to the decades. So you're fine. Like, let the industry mature. Let all these products take better shape. Like, get deeper in regulation first before you start moving out into those use cases. I know that's not necessarily the typical response of somebody saying urging caution, but it's like you have to be sensible, particularly when it comes to an SMSF. Like, there's a perfectly reasonable use case for derivatives for somebody who is trading regularly and is trying to hedge their position and is an actively managed portfolio. Makes total sense. SMSF, doesn't have the same requirement.
Well, you're betting against a professional in most cases. So who's going to win? Who's going to lose? Yeah, and I think that's the best non-financial advice that I've heard. Just take it slow and steady. What wins the race?
100%.
And just be sensible.
And for the record, like I'm what we call a hodler. Like I buy and hold, buy and hold, buy and hold. I think I've sold out of positions once, maybe twice, something like that. You know, I don't tend to sell out of it. And it's time and market, right? It's just sitting in there and growing what you have. And people have done well in it. We've got some clients of ours who bought crypto, held the asset, and particularly probably Bitcoin, because that's always been the biggest seller, and have cashed out and bought houses. They've just held it and held it and held it and held it and have cashed out and bought houses in Australia in this market. So, like, it's very possible to get those returns without the need to you know, create a lot of alchemy around the products that you're dealing with. Have fun in traditional markets with derivatives and structured products and so on. That's good fun there, because you've got far better at TMD and all the rest of it, and you'll have more sense of what it is that you're about than coming into crypto.
Yeah, and if you're getting into those synthetic products, I mean, you know, if you can't afford to lose it, don't bet is sort of the, yes, as you're more or less saying.
Yes.
So in the time that we've got left, I just want to touch on NFTs, because I really think that NFTs have copped a really bad reputation in super, because we usually connect that, as you've mentioned before, with the digital art, like the Crypto Kitties and the Bored Apes and the Pet Rocks, and the prices have tanked and they've been a poor investment choice traditionally. But I don't believe we really have our heads around NFTs in terms of that practical application that they have. And I'd really like to explore this a little bit more with you, because people don't think about an NFT as just being that smart contract on the blockchain. It's, you know, which can be any transaction which assigns, you know, that permanent ownership to that particular asset. So, Caroline, I know you're involved with RMIT as an advisory board member to their Digital 3 Research Hub, and they're doing some amazing research into the needs of business and into smart contracts and what they call the technologies of trust. And I think that's pretty cool. So how are they pioneering their way through that digital asset space? And what's your involvement as a board member? Because I think that'd be really exciting to be involved in that right now.
So RMIT itself are such a fantastic national resource for research in this space. And they've been doing it for a long time. Now, that particular board itself has wound down for various different reasons, but their engagement in the space hasn't changed in terms of their commitment. They have got from across discipline in RMIT involvement in blockchain. And we really need that both here in Melbourne and in other academic centres around Australia. What I would also say is that I think NFTs have been much maligned.
Agree.
And as you say, misunderstood, misinterpreted. The amount of NFT artists that come out of Australia, we absolutely punch above our weight. And I say that with somebody who thankfully have spent some time with NFT artists here locally. This isn't Bitcoin. This isn't Ethereum. This is a creative medium, right? Yeah. It's something completely different. And you shouldn't be in my view, as if you're investing in NFTs, this isn't something for a quick flip. This is how you would if you were buying the Mona Lisa. Not that, you know, but
this
is actually what you're dealing with. So it's a very different thought process. And again, going to that alternative investment kind of strategy that's suggested. And certainly NFTs sit under that. There's a fantastic NFT gallery in Melbourne called the Oshii Gallery, who are so cutting edge, who push the boundaries every single time. Their work at building a community for Australia and also overseas is second to none. I love working with them because they're so visionary. And as I say, it's been, a misunderstood category of this technology. But beyond the use cases of NFTs for art and as a medium of art and as a medium for music and other creative endeavors, an NFT can also be a ticket to go to the Australian Open. An NFT can also be a piece of fan memorabilia that you get that says, oh, yeah, you were at, you know, this particular gig. You were at Taylor Swift in an NFT format that verifies and is date stamped on the blockchain that you were the person that went through the gate. And you own that piece of that confirmed piece of memorabilia in the same way that we all, I don't know about you, but I've got ticket stubs upstairs in my bedroom from like REM back in the day and all kinds of ads. And now they're just moving that into an NFT format on the chain, on blockchain. Yes. And so there's that kind of utility. It also could be like your plane ticket. And this is where it actually gets quite interesting, because if your plane ticket is now in an NFT or tokenized format, when you onboard, the way that all of that technology can be connected, when your boarding pass gets swiped, it can trigger a message that gets sent to your travel insurer to say, okay, your travel insurance now kicks in because she's now on a plane. That can also trigger a message to be sent to your hotel to confirm that, yes, she's on the flight, so her arrival arrival time is now as it is, that can also be sent to your taxi driver that you've pre-booked that says, yep, on the flight, and it's on. And all of that information can be referred back to the flight that you're on, that's sending information out that says, flight is on time, no delays expected, and so on and so on and so on.
Wow.
And that's how you build out that blockchain ecosystem that I spoke about, but also shows the utility of an NFT, how it connects and integrates. And it's far more than just this sense of, oh, it's just some fluffy thing off the internet. Absolutely, emphatically not true. Absolutely not how it is. And it's rather ruinous to think, in the same way that I remember the early days, the early websites that we had for the internet, and they were crap. Dial-up was rubbish. Emails, you can barely send anything across it. Text messages were like, oh, wild. And look how far we've come with all this technology. And so to sit and think about what an NFT is today and decide this is the deciding and defining value of it is rubbish, absolute tosh. Mm-hmm. You really have to see how this is going. And I would strongly urge people to have a look at the Australian NFT artists. They're cutting above, you know, the rest of the world. They are fantastic. Go into something like Oshii Gallery to have a walk around, get educated and understand what's out there, and support our own. And I think that's really important too. Support our own, because gosh knows, you know, the rest of the world does it. So Aussie should do it here too.
Yeah. Oh, look, that's a fantastic way to leave the pod. And I could absolutely be here just forever discussing all things digital with you. But unfortunately, we have run out of time. So thank you so much for being here today and for sharing your experience. It's been, well, I've enjoyed the conversation. I'm hoping everybody else does. And I'm sure that they will get a lot out of it. So thank you once again.
Brilliant. Thank you so very much for having me.
Thank you for joining us for our discussion on Is Crypto a Complying SMSF Asset? And a massive thank you once again to Caroline Bowler for her expert insights on the blockchain, crypto, the digital regulatory framework, and how it all fits into an SMSF. While we have seen how complex the regulatory landscape is shaping up to be, the potential benefits of digital asset regulation far outweighs the challenges. Caroline's detailed analysis and practical advice has provided us all with a better understanding of how to navigate the crypto space safely and securely. If you're interested in understanding more about the compliance aspects of crypto and what evidence you need to provide to your auditor, please go to the ASF Audits website, get to the resources section, and there you will find articles on cryptos and NFTs, as well as a fact sheet. So until next time, please remember that our discussions are for SMSF compliance and information purposes only and should not be used as financial or legal advice in any way. If you like this episode, be sure to subscribe to the podcast and go to the asfaudits.com.au website, where you can sign up to my monthly newsletter, get access to other fact sheets, check out our articles, and follow us on social media to stay up to date on all things SMSF.